Welcome to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. And for Orion Samuelson, I'm Steve Alexander, and Max Armstrong will be along to join us in a few minutes with an agricultural commodities report. Let's begin, though, with the equities, and on Wall Street, let's call it a flat week. For the week, the S&P 500 was down 0.02%, the Dow was up 1.16%, and the NASDAQ was down 0.2%. On Friday, the S&P 500 lost 3.5 points at 2472, thanks mainly to negative reactions to earnings reports from high-profile names such as Amazon, Exxon, and Starbucks, also a drop in shares of tobacco companies after the FDA announced that it was going to propose lower levels of nicotine in cigarettes, down below the level at which nicotine is addictive. The Dow, however, set a record high lifted by Chevron after the energy company's results. The Dow was up 34 points at 21,831. And the NASDAQ lost 8 points on Friday, closing out the week at 6,374. Once again this week, earnings were driving the trading, although on Friday there were some disappointing results from big companies like Amazon, Starbucks, and Exxon. But despite those, results overall have come in better than expected for the second quarter, and stocks are trading near record highs. More than halfway through reporting season, S&P 500 companies are on track to increase earnings by 10.8%. Checking commodities, beginning with crude oil. Crude had a good week, hitting a two-month high in its strongest week of the year yet, closing in on $50 a barrel for U.S. crude. Traders attributed the activity to short covering of previous bearish bets as oil finished higher in every session this week. Crude settled at $49.71 a barrel, up 67 cents or 1.4%, and on the week gained nearly 9%. Gold rose to a six-week high on Friday after weaker-than-expected U.S. inflation dampened expectations that the U.S. Federal Reserve will aggressively raise interest rates, and North Korea fired a ballistic missile, and that triggered some safe-haven buying. Gold closed higher for the third week in a row. Gold futures for August delivery settling up 0.7% on Friday at $1,268.40. At the Chicago Board of Trade, wheat futures rose on Friday, lifted by signs of poor yields in drought-hit U.S. spring wheat belts. But the benchmark Chicago Board of Trade soft red winter wheat contract was still headed for a third straight weekly loss as crop troubles were set against ample global supplies. Corn and beans firmed on concerns about a dry weather forecast in some of the growing areas of the Midwest. September wheat futures ended up 1.25 cents at $4.81 a bushel. Soybean futures for November were up 5.5 cents at $10.13 a bushel. And December corn settled a quarter of a penny higher at $3.88 a bushel. For the week, corn futures were down 1.1%, soybean futures fell 1%, and wheat futures were down 3.6% for this week. Max Armstrong will have an ag commodities interview coming up a little later. But first, let's talk about something that is hanging over all of the markets, the equities and the commodities, and that is just how the Federal Reserve is going to go about unwinding its balance sheet. Joining me is Jeff Cox, the finance editor for CNBC.com. Over the course of his journalism career that began in 1987, Jeff has covered everything from the collapse of the financial system, presidential politics, local government battles in his native Pennsylvania, and on and on. He joined CNBC in 2007, really a great time, Jeff, to join, as the worst of the credit crisis was about to explode. And as CNBC, which for many of us now, CNBC is, you know, it's ever present, it's always there. But back then, it was a little bit in the formative stages, at least at the website. He helped chronicle the collapse of Bear Stearns and also then Lehman Brothers, and he has routinely written stories that are the most read items on the site each day, as he interviews some of the smartest and most well-respected analysts and advisors, in the financial world, and we're going to dumb that down a lot today. Jeff, welcome to the markets. Appreciate you taking time.
Glad to be here.
I enjoyed your comparison of the unwinding of the Fed's balance sheet to the Starship Enterprise. And let me just read that first line. Consider the Federal Reserve the Starship Enterprise of monetary policy. It went where no central bank had gone before, and now must plot the journey home. Well, let's talk about the journey out. Tell us when that began and how we got to where we are now.
Well, this all started back in 2008. As you mentioned in your intro, I was there to help chronicle the worst days of the financial crisis. In fact, I used to joke to folks when I came over to CNBC in 2007 that this probably meant the market top, because I had come to CNBC to devote myself to market coverage, and that probably bad things were going to follow. And of course, in October 2007, the market did top, and then we entered into a really perilous time for our country. In fact, on a lot of levels, the worst time since the Great Depression. So basically, as the markets in the financial world was spinning out of control, the Federal Reserve, which of course regulates banks but also sets monetary policy and interest rates, kind of stepped into the void there to try to get things back on some solid footing. Now, what they did were kind of two different things. I think a lot of your listeners will know that the Fed took interest rates down to close to zero, tried to get the mortgage industry going again, the housing industry going again. Another thing that they did that probably is not as well understood on Main Street is basically what the Fed did was they started to buy bonds. They started to buy treasuries and mortgage-backed securities, which are basically just like packages of mortgages put together and sold to investors. And what they did was just try to help steady that industry and try to just help get some liquidity going in the industry again, and try to just kind of get the economy going back forward by just injecting money into the economy. Now, what a lot of people will call this was the Fed's money printing stage, where they would just kind of give themselves these sort of digital dollars they could go out and do this stuff with.
This is also quantitative easing, then? Is that
quantitative easing is the more official name for it. So what happened from there is they did one round of this and that worked out okay. So then and then after they stopped, the market started to go into a tailspin again. So they started up again, and then we kind of went back on the upswing, and then they did another round of it and stopped, and then the markets fell off again. So they did a third round of this. So they did basically three rounds of this quantitative easing, as you mentioned, and all totaled, it came to about $3.7 trillion. So if you took that and added the about $800 billion that was already on the Fed balance sheet, and we get this number of $4.5 trillion that the Fed's balance sheet is on, and that's where we come to today.
And your article that landed on the CNBC site on Tuesday indicated that the Fed is going to announce the balance sheet roll-off plan in September. How is this? It seems to me that this is like giving money to a relative, a child or somebody who always fails. So you keep giving them money and giving them money, and all of a sudden you're going to stop giving them money. And what happens?
Yeah, well, this is where we get into the Star Trek analogy, that we're out in the great beyond, and they've boldly gone where no central bank has ever gone before, and now they have to figure out a way to get back. And now if you ask the Fed officials, their opinion is that they can do this in a pretty benign fashion, that they're going to just do this very slowly. It's going to end up being they're going to start out at $10 billion a month. So, I mean, you look at $10 billion and compare that to $4.5 trillion. Wow, that's a long distance between there. So they're going to increase that quarterly. That $10 billion is going to go from $10 billion this quarter, $20 billion the following quarter, and then until we're going to do that for a year, until we get up to $50 billion a month in Fed balance sheet roll-off. Nobody knows how exactly far they're going to go with that. I think Wall Street speculation right now is that they'll basically cut that balance sheet about in half. So we'll get down to maybe about $2 trillion, and then they'll try to sort of stabilize it around there. This all gets very arcane and obtuse, but What they're just hoping is that it's in such small increments, and the market will be able to absorb. I think that's the big question. If the Fed's not buying these bonds, who's going to buy them? So they're hoping that the private market will step in there and buy those bonds, and that it won't affect interest rates so much. They'll be able to continue to keep interest rates low, historically speaking, and that this whole balance sheet alchemy will turn out okay in the end.
Yeah, but they're going to be doing this at the same time they're raising rates, right? Presumably,
that's correct. And I think that's sort of a vexing thing for a lot of people when you say, "Geez, well, why do they want to raise interest rates?" You would think that in most cases they would only be forced into raising interest rates. We certainly don't have an inflation problem in the country. It's hard for a lot of folks to understand exactly why they feel the need to raise rates here. I think the answer to that is just simply because they kept rates so low for so long. I think you can make an excellent argument, and I've made mainly because I made this argument many times, that they waited so far past when the crisis was over to start normalizing policy, that now they sort of find themselves in the position to, like, geez, we better start to raise rates, because if we do get another crisis, we're not going to have any tools. We're not going to have anywhere to go to just say, okay, hey, we're going to help the economy like we did back during the financial crisis by cutting rates. Well, if rates are already near zero, do the math. You can't really do anything with rates. So it's perilous and it's risky, and it's got some folks worried. We've certainly been told by Fed officials before, in fact, some of the same Fed officials who are making the decisions right now, that, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. It's no big deal. The Fed told us back in 2007 that the subprime crisis was, in the words of the chairman back then, Ben Bernanke, contained, that it wasn't likely to spread through the economy. Of course, they were tragically, catastrophically wrong with that assessment, and, I guess we hope that they know what they're doing here, and that they won't once again be wrong in underestimating the ramifications of what they're doing.
Yeah, the man behind the curtain, or more recently, the woman behind the curtain, perhaps.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah, perhaps painting themselves into a corner, as you suggested there. But this is, at that rate that you were mentioning earlier, the $50 billion per year, I believe it added up to.
A year from when they start doing it, which is presumably that'll be in September, will be up to $50 billion a month, where they're basically, what they're doing is each month from the bonds that they get a certain level of proceeds. It's actually, it's quite a bit of money. And what they've been doing with those proceeds is they've just been reinvesting those proceeds. So they've just been going out when a bond rolls off and they get the money from that, they just go out and they buy more bonds with the idea of just keeping the balance sheet rather at a level rate. What they're now going to do is they're going to set these caps, and up to that cap level, which will be $50 billion, they'll let that much roll off every month without reinvesting that.
Okay, and back to your point earlier, who is going to buy these bonds if they're not buying the bonds?
Well, my market contacts, as folks that I've talked to, tell me that the Fed has been in contact and with the private market, with bond traders and whatnot out there, and they've been assured that there's a market for these bonds. That this will all happen at the New York Fed's trading desk. They'll be in charge of this operation, and that they feel pretty comfortable with the market contacts that they have. That there's enough appetite for government debt out there in the private market that they'll be able to sell these at not much higher of an interest rate where we're at now, which is the government bond yields are still pretty low at this point.
Well, we hope that works out, obviously. This journey back for this Starship Enterprise, how long will this take?
Well, I guess in the original series Star Trek, they said 5 years which it was there. I think the initial reaction with that voiceover from William Shatner said it's 5-year mission, and coincidentally enough, I think they are figuring all this to take about 5 years until they reach the point where they finally said, okay, we've rolled off enough from the balance sheet.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've talked about some of the things that could go wrong. What's the worst case scenario here?
Well, the worst case scenario is that as they're trying to do this, they don't find the market for it, or you know, I guess the really worst case scenario is that the economy starts to unravel. We go into a recession, and nobody wants to buy bonds. In that case, particularly if we've got inflation going at the same time, and that the Fed's got these two kind of conflicting things going on where they're going to need to try to ease economic conditions on one hand and at the same time while they're tightening policy, so they would have to just pretty much cease that operation, which they can do, of course, but the problem is that how much damage have you caused? How much uncertainty have you caused, and does this become at some point damaging to the market psyche and to investors? You know that you have this sort of Federal Reserve that doesn't really seem to know what it's doing. So I think it's just the unknown here. It's just the unknown of like how does this all work at a time when the economy is just trying to get its footing going. You have a Fed that's trying to tighten policy, that's trying to kind of control growth, and you sort of wonder why at this point. I mean, we just saw that the economy grew at 2.6% in the second quarter, only 1.2% in the first quarter, so that's not exactly robust growth. We're still kind of stuck in that 2% range, and you just wonder why the Fed feels the need that they need to get tighter with policy here. So you just figure that the most recent, the Bank of America does a fund manager survey each month, and the fund managers said that their biggest worry is a Fed policy mistake, which is a pretty broad brush to paint with, but the market's just worried that the Fed doesn't really understand the ramifications of what it's doing. So I think that's sort of just, you know, the short way to answer your question is just that that, you know, what could go wrong here? The Fed could just make a mistake. It could just not be understanding the ramifications of what it's going to be doing, and it just ends up causing general market disturbance.
Yeah, whatever decision the Fed makes is really Janet Yellen's legacy, is it not?
Well, and I think that's a very important point here. It's entirely possible that Janet Yellen does not get reappointed when her term ends in February, and I think that she wants to leave office if that is in fact what she ends up doing, with the legacy that yes, we pulled out all the stops to resuscitate the economy, but I'm leaving here now with we're kind of, you know, backing and filling along the way, and we're normalizing policy. She very much wants to be able to say when she leaves office that policy is getting back to normal and that the Fed is leaving. She's leaving things with the Fed on stable ground.
Jeff Cox, the finance editor at CNBC.com. You can follow Jeff on Twitter at JeffCoxCNBC.com. Jeff, thanks very much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
Welcome back to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. In for Orion Samuelson, I'm Steve Alexander. And here comes Max Armstrong with a special guest.
With us this weekend, Brian Basting from Advanced Trading, Bloomington, Illinois. Welcome back.
Thank you, sir.
We need to get a crop update from you and how crops look across the wide expanse of the Corn Belt area. Most all of the major corn-producing states are looking at yields lower than a year ago, right?
The perception at this point, Max, is yes, most of the major states maybe won't quite reach that 2016 level. It's still premature to say that for sure, however, but all indications today are that several of those states, not all of them, may not reach that 16 level.
I'm headed to Minnesota in the week ahead, and I understand that may be the best corn of the major corn-producing states, better than Iowa.
Yeah, that's what we understand, Max. Some exceptional conditions in a lot of key areas. Minnesota, they've had some really good timely moisture this summer. Temperatures haven't been too extreme, so that's the perception we get of some of the best corns in Minnesota this summer.
What are you thinking in terms of the corn yield? What kind of a number do you have in mind for the nationwide corn yield? You wouldn't be down to 160, would you? That low?
At this point, Max, it is a moving target, of course, here and at the end of July. But the perception that we have at this point is that perhaps it's shy of what the USDA is indicating at 170.7. Our bias at this point, given the crop conditions and what we see today, is that it may be a hair under 165, maybe in that 164, 164 and a half range. Again, that number is going to change, as we all know, as your listeners know, between now and harvest, but that's where we're leaning today.
I hear 163, 164 tossed around quite a bit, so that must be pretty close to where the market is trading, you think?
It feels that way. You know, maybe I think as we go forward, the market may be a touch higher than that just because of what's happened the last 3 years. We've had some stellar yields in 14 to 16, and even the 15 yield exceeded our expectations.
As we've watched market activity, it seems like rallies have faded rather quickly with weather forecasts. What's your feeling here over the next few days? I mean, when will we have the idea that this corn crop is made?
I think that the seed we've planted with our folks that we work with, Max, is that this year what's going to be the challenge is the export market. This fall especially, with that record crop that they're in the midst of harvesting in Brazil, those bushels are going to displace the U.S. bushels. So here's our key point. Even if we do trim this corn yield back a bit from what we're looking at today, that could be easily offset by some strong, strong competition in the export market from Brazil and Argentina this fall.
Will some of that come into the United States? What's your feeling on that, especially when you look at where the deficit of our crop may be, the Eastern Corn Belt, crop that is often railed down to the chickens and hogs in North Carolina, down to the Southeast? Could there be some of that crop coming in from South America to that area?
Yes, there could be. We've heard some talk about that. Of course, you just have to see how it plays out as you go forward here into late summer and early fall. But that's certainly a possibility, given the ample supply that they do have in South America. And as you just really did a nice description of what the challenge could be in that Southeast feeding area.
The soybean crop, no doubt, has benefited from the recent rains. And if the rains continue, it will be an even larger crop. What's your general feeling about soybeans at this moment?
Well, the USDA did drop the crop condition ratings for Sunday through Sunday quite a bit, but that was prior to the rains, of course, in some cases. I guess the best we can say today is that the soybeans are really surprised us to the upside the last couple years, so don't ever underestimate what that soybean plant can do, but August is still critical. We need to get some more rains here in August for that pod set, pod fill. So I think it's premature yet, but today we think that maybe it's a bit below what the USDA at least has on the balance sheet.
You noted that the condition ratings went down in that most recent report. That's not unusual this time of year. We generally see that in July, do we not?
You know, it's interesting. That's true. Usually true, Max. The last couple years, however, at least back in 16, it was very stable all summer at a very high level, and that's not been the case this year. That rating has been deteriorating. It's not near as bad as 2012. I want to remind your listeners of that. It's nothing like 2012. However, it is below what we've seen the last few years.
2012, it just fell off the cliff, didn't it?
Yeah.
Then last year, as you pointed out, it was remarkably stable, and we had some pretty doggone good yields.
Yeah, the best yields ever for soybeans in many areas last year, Max, nationwide, best yield ever. And that was really played out with that high yield or high crop condition rain you just mentioned all summer.
What are you looking at in terms of market activity now? Of course, obviously, the big crop report is coming up in just a few days, the August crop report, and then we'll have all of the private surveys, people running out and looking at the fields later on in the month of August. So these, no doubt, will bring some gyrations to the market.
I think that's a good word, Max, gyrations. Stop and start, particularly when we look at corn. The start would be to the upside would be concerns that we are going to fall short of what the USDA is penciling in for 2017 in the U.S. yield. But to stop would be that South American supply. And I think that's what the keeping the market in check here with that export competition we're seeing this fall. For the bean market, with that August weather is critical because we've got tremendous demand for beans. Now, the same situation for beans that we saw for corn, more competition coming from South America, particularly Brazil, in the export market this fall. So again, I would caution your listeners, growers out there, that we do have competition on the way that was not present last fall.
Shifting gears a little bit to the wheat crop. Of course, all of the excitement this summer was in spring wheat, and it spilled over into the other classes, but there is no shortage of wheat in those other classes, correct?
That's a great point, Max. I think what we really saw was an opportunity for the U.S. grower here, particularly the hard red wheat grower who was in the middle of harvest and saw that really, really good rally there to go ahead and aggressively sell their crop. Some of the soft wheat crop was not quite harvested yet when we had that spike in prices, but you hit the nail on the head. Outside of the U.S., shortfall in the spring wheat up in the plains, we are not seeing a shortage of wheat worldwide. However, we want to keep an eye on Southern Hemisphere. We want to keep an eye on Australia. We want to keep an eye on Argentina moving forward.
What kind of signals will this send to the United States wheat grower? After that greatly reduced wheat acreage from last year, the smallest winter wheat acreage in the United States in a century, I guess. What will the wheat grower do this fall as you see it, Brian?
Some of it's probably still playing out, Max. However, the early indications are that maybe we will see a bit of an uptick in U.S. wheat plantings this fall. However, as we know, at the end of July here, we still got several weeks before we really get into that wheat planting, and if the market may give signals one way or another to change those plans. But that's the early indications we've got. We may see a bit of an uptick from where they were last year.
You've alluded to this a couple of times already, that export demand, generally speaking, is it still strong?
Well, for the corn, it's respectable, Max. We're shipping 35 to 40 million bushels a week. However, that's well below what it was last year at this time because of the shortfall in Brazil last year really opened up a window for U.S. exports. For soybeans, we're shipping 15 to 20 a week. I think that both of those numbers will continue to tail off as we get into fall here. And I really think that we could see the soybean export program back off maybe 100, 150 million bushels from what it was last year. And the corn export program in the SON quarter, September, October, November quarter, could be 150 to 200 million bushels lower than what it was last year, just because of that competition.
One would imagine that as long as rains keep popping up over the corn belt of the United States, as showers keep falling into the corn and bean fields, overseas buyers are not going to have a sense of urgency to make sure supplies are booked, correct?
You hit the nail on the head, Max. The new crop book for corn export sales was one of the lowest we've seen in about 11 years. In other words, a foreign buyer, as you really hit the nail on the head again a moment ago, is not anxious to buy U.S. corn because they know that South American supply is there. And as a result, we're really seeing those new crop corn export sales off to a weak start here.
As you visit with growers when they call you, as you talk to them on the phone, what's their attitude? You know, generally speaking, some are looking at some, well, they had a tough start to this crop. Of course, the drought country of the Dakotas, that's been nasty. The Eastern Corn Belt, difficulties in planting. Those who are looking at pretty good crops now, maybe also looking at better prices than they expected, even though they're not rip-roaring. We haven't seen that tremendous rally this summer. But are they feeling generally okay about their situation?
It's a mixed bag, Max. I think with the wheat was really a surprise, a pleasant surprise to the wheat grower that they were able to get that rally, particularly for the hard wheat growers out in the West, and were able to sell that wheat at a much higher price than they anticipated. The soft wheat folks who got their crop priced or got the early harvest off were in the same boat. The soybean market has given a real good opportunity again, back to the levels we had not seen since last fall. In terms of soybeans, corn has been a bit of frustration. We just stop and start. We have not seen that corn market in a grower's eyes, many growers' eyes, up to a point where they want to be real aggressive yet. We'll just have to see how that plays out. But it's kind of a mixed bag, but I think most growers feel pretty good about their corn and soybean crops this year.
Doggone it, the bad word has become Safrina, hasn't it? That second crop in South America, that corn crop that, as you point out, is hanging over the market now.
It was a short crop last year, Max, that really gave an opportunity to U.S. growers, an opportunity for the export market. This year, we flipped that around 180 degrees, the largest Safrina crop ever. And that's really going to be a thorn in the side of U.S. exports this fall, probably all the way into early 18.
Brian, it's always good to have you here, and we appreciate you stopping by this weekend. Thank you.
Always good to be with you, Max.
Brian Basting from Advance Trading.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
And that does it for The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. In for Orion Samuelson, and along with Max Armstrong, I'm Steve Alexander.